Sunstone presents Mormonism and the Community Experience. Shall Zion Wait Forever? Recorded live at the 1986 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 20th through the 23rd. We take you to the Salt Lake Sheraton and Towers, where the program is just now beginning.
Just a few things I'd like to say before we turn our time over to the planned speaker. This room is going to be privileged by hearing the paper, Mormonism and the Community Experience, Shall Zion Wait Forever? I'd like to remind all of you that the admission to the Sunstone Symposium is by your name tag, and they appreciate it if they're visible so that we can recognize those among us we'd like to chat with and renew old acquaintances and some new acquaintances. The paper today, as I mentioned, is Mormonism and the Community Experience, prepared by Sandra P. Cook and Clayton Cook. Sandra Cook received her Bachelor of Arts and Humanities at Brigham Young, and Clayton Cook received his Bachelor's in Science in Anthropology at Brigham Young. Theirs was a joint effort in preparing the paper today, and therefore it seems quite fitting that the joint effort that they are both experiencing and hoping that will occur in the next few days is a joint experience also, because Sandra Cook is going to deliver a baby within a few days, their first, and asked to be excused today. However, their paper is a joint effort, and I'm sure you can recognize the touch that is involved. After the paper has been and the slideshow been presented, we'd like to turn the time over to questions and comments. I have asked Clayton if he would repeat the question from the stand so that we all can hear, and we are being recorded so that this will be available on cassette. So if you will speak loudly with your comments and your questions, and maybe perhaps Clayton could repeat them over the microphone so that we can be certain that they are recorded. I'd like to turn the time over to Clayton Cook. Thank you very much. I won't take the paper.
Thank you. Just as clarification, Sandy and I wrote two papers originally, and she was going to present one, then we were going to have the slideshow, and then I was going to present the second paper, but since we found out that she couldn't come because they didn't want to want her to have the baby at 6,000 feet in the airplane, so we decided to combine the papers together. And so I will read the first part, and then we'll have the slide presentation, and I'll read the second part. So it's basically the same. If I begin to read too fast, it's probably because I've received a high sign that she's having the baby, so I don't think that'll happen. Mormonism and the Community Experience, Shall Zion Wait Forever? Throughout my church experience, I, perhaps like many of you, have had to struggle with historical contradictions, doctrinal ambiguities, and Mormon ethnocentrism. I have been guided through these struggles by fellow seekers on the path who have given me simple yet profound images to cling to, such as Leah Honas and Iron Rodders, the closet doubter, the emerging new Mormons, and what the church means to people like me. I am continually amazed by the testimonies we bear and the undying faith we express in the religious culture we have created for ourselves. As I have worked with the weak threads of my own testimony, I have recognized that the one spark of hope which has allowed me to remain within the institutional church has been the hope of Zion. I fondly remember as a young boy in the 53rd Ward in Ogden, Utah, how we dedicated our time and resources to the building of our new ward chapel. I also recall feeling a spirit of togetherness and brotherhood as we collected eggs at the Sake Welfare Farm, and as we performed with some trepidation the annual vaccinating of the Lord's Blessed Chickens. These activities, along with many others, provided me with short yet profound glimpses of the Zion spirit. As the years went by, these short glimpses of Zion became fewer and farther between, and the dream itself began to fade. My college years were highlighted by fireside discussions with roommates and friends as we contemplated ways of promoting the spirit of cooperation both inside and outside the church. Our shared dreams of a cooperative farm quickly fell victim to the accepted realities of the free enterprise system and the rampant materialism of our modern world. It was at this time that I met my wife, and in her found a soulmate with a similar dream of Zion. One day, while browsing through a local bookstore, I noticed a book entitled The Findhorn Garden. We had recently moved into our first home in Spanish Fork and were attempting with marginal success to grow our own vegetables. Findhorn was a place in northern Scotland where a sand dune and a garbage dump had been turned into a wonderful garden producing larger than normal vegetables. I thought with some luck their techniques could surely work for us as well. I purchased the book, and as we looked through its pages, we discovered an amazing story, not only about a garden, but about a cooperative community that was living the concepts of a United Christian Brotherhood. We then came across an article about the Plenty Project, sponsored by an intentional community in Tennessee called The Farm. They're a group of 800 people, bought land together, and once their needs were met on a minimal level, they contributed all their surplus time and money to relieve the poverty and sickness of their local and distant neighbors. These two examples of voluntary cooperation carried our dreams of Zion to lofty yet doubting heights. Having both been raised under the assumption that anything outside our church must be looked at as a potential counterfeit of God's plan, we continue to ask ourselves discriminating questions about these people in Scotland and Tennessee. But what kept coming up for us was the goodness of their everyday deeds, their undying faith in God, and their love for mankind. We were reminded of the words of Moroni in chapter 7, "Wherefore all things which are good come of God." Experiencing the desire to learn more about these groups, we began collecting books about cooperative communities. We wrote to Findhorn, subscribed to their magazine, and eventually visited them for several weeks during the summer of 1984. During our visit, we found that Findhorn was only part of a worldwide network consisting of thousands of communities, intentional communities, living under the principles of love, goodwill, and equality. We continued to be impressed by the sincerity of these people and concerned about the fact that there seemed to be no active involvement of the church in this effort. This concern led us to writing Elder Neil Maxwell. We chose to write him because of the spirit of cooperation and Zion most richly expressed in his book of One Heart. In our letter, we mentioned some of the groups we had contacted outside the church and asked if there were any efforts within the church to practice the vision of Zion expressed by the prophet Joseph Smith and others. In his reply, he expressed caution about such groups, mentioning other idealistic saints who had moved to Missouri and been disappointed. He explained his concern, and I quote, "Obviously, one of our reasons for being cautious is that we live within existing political and economic systems which have, so to speak, lifestyles of their own, including stern laws and regulations," end quote. This surprised us because of the groups we had contacted across the country who live in a system of cooperation and unity without breaking these civil laws. He went on to say, "Absent prophetic and institutional direction, I would be very cautious about affiliating with certain groups. This is not to question the ideals or motives of all those involved. Rather, it is a matter of recognizing the reality that our faith in the Lord includes faith in His timing. There have been so many instances of disappointment, diminished devotion, administrative ambiguity, etc., that I speak of the need for us to wait upon the Lord." End quote. This has created for us a tremendous dilemma. On one hand, we are told by our church leaders that the time is not yet right. We are to wait on the Lord. And on the other hand, we see groups throughout the world that are not waiting, but are actively engaged in building a more humane and sustainable culture. Our traditional Mormon scenario for the last days is in conflict with our new experience. The role of the church to do missionary work, temple work, and to perfect the saints seems somehow too narrow, too focused on ourselves. Our intention today is not to question the authority of the church, but to simply point out some noteworthy parallels between the dream of Zion that we as a church are waiting for and the reality of Zion that others are building. The concept of a Zion community is as old as the foundations of the earth, having been taught to Enoch in the days of Adam as part and parcel of the gospel. One of the greatest traditions found in the scriptures is that of the city of Enoch, where for 365 years the people lived in common unity with no rich or poor, all being of one heart. We find a similar tradition among the early secular philosophers who emphasized that the primal childhood of the human race and the natural order of man was made up of communal living and the absence of personal property. The early Christian church attempted to live the principles of unity that Christ taught during his ministry. We also find the tradition of a unified community of believers in the New World. In 4th Nephi we read, And they had all things in common among them. Therefore they were not rich and poor, bond and free, but they were all made free and partakers of the heavenly gifts. For 200 years the people of Nephi lived in perfect unity in Christ. Despite the division that occurred shortly after this time, the threads of unity and cooperation lived on in many of the traditions of the native peoples of America. Many parts of the United States were settled on communal traditions due to the hard life of the frontier. Joseph Smith was influenced by these communal dreams and by the dream of unity he found in the Bible. One of the major aspects of his work was the effort to organize and unify a structured haven for his followers in a society that seemed about to disintegrate from the excesses of individualism and pluralism. This became more urgent with the influx of newly converted saints to Ohio, many of whom were poor and destitute. In February of 1831, less than a year after the church was organized, Joseph went to the Lord with this problem. In response, the Lord revealed to him the principles of right human relations and communal living contained in the law of consecration and stewardship. Although this law would reflect the social and cultural context of the times, it contained the basic principles of a Zion society, as found in Moses 7 and 18. And the Lord called his people Zion because, first, they were of one heart and one mind. Second, they dwelt together in righteousness. And third, there were no poor among them. From the Lord's specific instructions to the early saints, we can learn much about these three principles of a Zion society. In speaking of temporal equality, he states in D&C 70, "In your temporal things you shall be equal, and this not grudgingly." And in 104, "Behold, this is the way that I, the Lord, have decreed to provide for my saints, that the poor shall be exalted, in that the rich are made low." Although this equalizing process of the Lord may sound harsh and even unfair by contemporary standards of free enterprise and individualism, it is even more strongly stated in Doctrine and Covenants 49:20. "But it is not given that one man should possess that which is above another, wherefore the world lieth in sin." In these few words is found the condemnation of every man-made economic or political system that gives one man the right to own possessions above another. All that exists upon the earth is the Lord's, and it is not ours to own, nor to sell, or make a profit on. It is His will that every man share in the growth that comes from the exercise of stewardship, responsibility, and accountability. In Doctrine and Covenants 104 we read, "For it is expedient that I, the Lord, should make everyone accountable as a steward over earthly blessings, which I have prepared for my creatures. For the earth is full, and there is enough and to spare. And it pleaseth God that He hath given all these things unto man, for unto this end were they made, to be used with judgment, not to excess, neither by extortion." Unfortunately, mankind as a whole has chosen the path of excess and extortion, creating a world of poverty and fear of want. If we can understand and accept that God has provided us with more than enough for all, if managed justly through good stewardship, then the myth of competition dissolves before the true laws of cooperation and mutual benefit. The need to become of one heart and mind is the second essential element of a Zion society. As Christ taught, "If ye are not one, ye are not mine." Being of one heart and one mind identifies a unity of thought, a unity of purpose, and a unity of direction, of force, and of action. This is not to say that there is only one way to look at things. Rather, there is a conscious effort to bring all the different ideas into a unified synthesis. We must understand the difference between unanimity of one soul and uniformity of one form. Unanimity refers to having identical intentions. Diversity of effort, expression, and form are perfectly compatible with unanimous purpose. One expression of unity is governance by common consent. The United Order and the Church were both to be governed by common consent. In Doctrine and Covenants 104 we read, "And let all things be done according to the counsel of the order and united consent or voice of the order." And in Section 6, "And all things shall be done by common consent in the Church by much prayer and faith." Joseph Smith's basic political philosophy followed from this when he explained, "We believe in teaching them correct principles and letting them govern themselves." This seems to indicate that the Lord's plan is to give people the responsibility to make decisions for themselves and to govern themselves using their free agency through common consent. This type of unity is based not only on love, but also on honesty, which brings us to the last major attribute of a Zion society, a people who dwell together in righteousness. In Doctrine and Covenants, Section 51, "Let every man deal honestly and be alike among this people and receive alike, that ye may be one, even as I have commanded you." And again in Section 82, "Every man seeking the interest of his neighbor and doing all things with an eye single to the glory of God." Since Cain's first exploit against Abel for the sake of personal gain, Many have rationalized away the need to be concerned for the welfare of anyone but themselves and their immediate families. Seeking the glory of God or the interest of our neighbor are generally furthest from our mind as we make vocational or career choices, decide how to spend our money, or use our free time. The point is, if the welfare of our fellow man isn't our main concern in this life, then we are not spiritually ready for celestial living. When Jesus was asked, "Who is my neighbor?" he answered with the parable of the Good Samaritan. As we know, the injured was passed by a priest and a Levite before being cared for a member of the ethnic minority, one considered to be unclean. Here we are cautioned not to get so wrapped up in our righteousness that we forget to show mercy to our brothers and sisters in need. This is reiterated in Mormon chapter 8, verse 36, as an ancient prophet views us in these last days. "For behold, ye do love money, and your substance, and your fine apparel, and the adornment of your churches, more than you love the poor, and the needy, and the sick, and the afflicted." When the Lord explained to Joseph Smith in June of 1834 why the saints were not to be redeemed, the reason was specific. The saints had not been willing to comply with these requirements of equality, unity, and brotherly love. In section 105, we read, "But behold, they have not learned to be obedient to the things which I require at their hands, but are full of all manner of evil, and do not impart of their substance as becometh saints to the poor and afflicted among them, and are not united according to the union required by the laws of the celestial kingdom." If Zion is to be built again, then it will only occur when a people exist on the earth who are willing to abide by these laws. That we are not now living them is evident from the fact that Zion has not been established. The question we need to ask ourselves is, what are we doing to bring Zion about now? There are people in the world who are striving to build a Zion society, although they may call it humane, sustainable culture, planetary consciousness, or creating heaven on earth. To see how the principles of equality, unity, and brotherly love relate to the values and philosophies of these groups, I'd like to share with you now a slideshow portraying the lifestyles of 14 intentional communities across the country and in other countries as well. But first of all, by way of definition of an intentional community, when we speak of intentional communities, we exclude both the communes, which were the centers of free love and drug abuse that arose in the 60s, and cults. In Builders of the Dawn, written by Gordon Davidson and Corinne McLaughlin, former members of Finhorn, the authors discuss the difference between cults and intentional communities, and I quote, "To us, the bottom line that distinguishes what might be called a cult from a community is the interference with a person's free will, rather than a nurturance of its use. Free will is the most basic and inviolate spiritual principle on the earth, and a true spiritual teacher will respect a person's free will and encourage a follower to freely make his or her own choices and to take responsibility for any mistakes made and to learn from them." So now we'll look at the slides. Could someone turn on the projector and hit the lights?
Jewish communities are living a future now, creating centers of positive vision amidst the fear and crisis in the world. These communities are living their dreams by escaping the 9-to-5 grind, living a healthier lifestyle close to nature's beauty, and building a better world for themselves and their children. These communities are serving as research and development centers for society, experimenting with alternative energy, organic agriculture, holistic health, self-governance, and new forms of conflict resolution. Alternative communities are well and alive in the 80s, and today reflect a diversity of lifestyles and values. From totally communal rural groups, where all resources and housing are shared, like Renaissance Community in Massachusetts, to suburban communities of professionals with individual housing and income, like Stella Community in Illinois. Many communities, like Twin Oaks in Virginia, are developing self-sufficiency in food and energy. Prior to 21 years ago, Twin Oaks has a highly structured communal economic system and is also demonstrating the financial success of worker-owned and managed businesses through their hammock companies, which is the main source income for their 100 members. Calhoun Community, an educational center in Wisconsin, has had a grant from the U.S. Department of Energy to experiment with a bioshelter. A non-consuming micro-farm with a passive solar heating system, an attached greenhouse, and fish-producing tanks. Calhoun is also building ferro-cement domes for accommodation and outdoor solar hot water showers. Calhoun, along with Ceres Community in Massachusetts and Finholme Community in Scotland, are co-sponsoring the University of the Future. A semester course living and studying in the three communities for 12 units of credit to the University of Wisconsin. Stella Community in Illinois, based on the philosophy of the book The Ultimate Frontier, is now a community of 125 members developing a new age city with individually owned homes and a community school for children. Stella has experimented with solar air heaters and developed industrial-grade alcohol made from corn during machinery. They are also investigating new sources of electrical power and have their own plastic factory. Stella received a grant from the Illinois Department of Energy to build a commercial-sized greenhouse for food production. Ceres Community, founded in 1978, is a spiritual educational center on 86 acres in Massachusetts. Committed to living lightly on the earth in ecological balance and offering educational programs on themes such as New Age politics. For membership lands, tools, and community buildings, each family and individual provides for its own lifestyle. They're experimenting with new techniques of organic agriculture for growing more food in less space. Cultivate herbs for healing purposes, and use meditation and attunement to the forces of nature to enlist their cooperation and to affirm the sacredness of all life. Ceres members are operating a successful solar construction company called Rainbow Builders, where each member is a worker owner and all decisions are made by consensus. Spring Valley Community in New York, with 300 members, is based on the teachings of Rudolf Steiner and was founded in 1928. They grow most of their own food, have their own health clinic, and a Waldorf school for 300 children from preschool to high school. The school emphasizes the development of the arts and creativity along with traditional subjects. Holistic health and self-help techniques are being developed in many New Age communities, such as the Center of the Light Community in Massachusetts, who are studying the cultivation and use of herbal medicine. Many communities, like Seven Oaks in Virginia, are pioneering new forms of conflict resolution through therapeutic techniques for transforming negative emotions. Seven Oaks also offers solstice celebrations to help people become more in harmony with nature and the earth. Esalen Institute in California, for 20 years a pioneer of the human potential movement, teaches people self-help techniques and body work, psychological growth, and conflict resolution. Esalen is pioneering new approaches to international conflict resolution by sponsoring citizen exchanges between the Soviets and Americans. A non-cooperative village in California offers quiet retreats and teaches yoga and meditation. Anonymous 300 members support themselves through several businesses, like this health food store and a craft and clothing store in town. Ananda has experimented with geodesic domes for meeting halls and residences. Chinook Community is a spiritual and educational center offering programs to the public in Washington State. Chinook is developing into a new age village with associate members buying nearby land and houses and operating businesses like this bookstore in town. Urugo Community in India is an international community of 500 members in 23 countries. Urugo was partially funded by UNESCO and is working to reforest the desert and develop new forms of art, education, and self-government. Kingdom Community in Scotland started 21 years ago. It's famous for growing unusually large and healthy vegetables on sandy soil with a harsh northern climate by communicating with the forces of nature. Today, a planetary village of 200 members from many diverse nations and backgrounds, Kinghorn offers spiritual and educational programs and networks with thousands of other New Age communities around the world. Successful New Age communities can be found today in every modern country in the world. Each of these New Age communities has a unique contribution to make to society by pioneering new solutions to current problems and helping people in their personal growth. By cooperating together and invoking the bright light of spirit, these builders of a new world are awakening the power of a positive vision in the hearts of humanity, a new hope for our world.
Someone catch the lights, huh? In considering Mormonism and the community experience, I believe there is much we can learn from the dedicated efforts and far-sighted vision of these communities. We are not claiming that the people living in these communities are building the Lord's appointed Zion. Rather, we wish to point out that they have freely turned their backs on the world, sacrificing monetary success and security in order to live the essential elements of a Zion society. With regards to our first principle, equality, the new community movement asserts that by right livelihood, right use of resources, talents, and time, equality and abundance can come to all, and those who participate in such a system will find the growth and creativity that comes from custodianship and responsibility over God's creations. A strong work ethic exists in most communities, and work is often referred to as love made visible. Community businesses, which are generally worker-owned and operated, are founded on trust, love, and caring, rather than competition and profit. Members of the farm in Tennessee believe that the true economic conflict at work in the world today is one of poverty versus wealth. Quoting Stephen Gaskin, their founder, "The real distance isn't between communism and capitalism, it's between somebody who drinks bottled water from another continent and people who have to carry unsanitized water on their backs." Since its inception in the 1970s, this community has rejected the ideas of scarcity and economic competition in favor of the view that there is plenty now. In an effort to live this truth, they turn all their surplus outward to others in need. Their projects in Bangladesh, Lesotho, Africa, Guatemala, Haiti, along with their free ambulance service in the South Bronx, have all been funded by their surplus for the whole world and all its people. This focus on planetary economics is shared by many New Age communities. They define economics as Earth household, believing that if we care for the planetary economy as we would our own household or our own community, we can then see that it must work for all members of the Earth, or it really won't work for any part of the human family in the long term. What will work in the long term is abundance for all through sharing and good stewardship. Through faith in this abundance, they believe we can act as if it already exists and do what we know is spiritually right for ourselves and others, trusting that it will work out economically for everyone, despite how it may appear to the rational mind. The principle of unity is reflected in the area of community politics is centered around the issues of power, authority, and decision-making. Intentional communities generally feel each individual has perfect guidance through the still small voice within. Through common consent, true leadership, and seeking the good of the whole, power and authority are used to facilitate decision-making and allow the most personal growth. The main goal of these communities is to empower individuals to draw forth leadership in everyone rather than to create dependence on leaders, no matter how enlightened they may be. To accomplish this, leaders focus on education rather than direction. Quoting Builders of the Dawn, community governance is based on one of two assumptions. The old assumption was that people were basically unable to direct themselves or take responsibility, so leaders have to take care of them. The new assumption is that people already have the potential wisdom and creativity within them, so the task of leadership is mainly to educate and encourage. End quote. The Finhorn community reaches consensus through group meditation and attunement. First, the facts surrounding an issue are discussed. Then members are encouraged to express their feelings. The third step is a group meditation where all present attempt to release their personal opinions about the issue and seek guidance from the divine mind on what is the right decision for the group of the whole, for the good of the whole. When all have received a spiritual confirmation of the rightness of a decision, they can then move forward with one heart and one mind. All major decisions are approved by the community membership through consensus. In this manner, the community is governed from the bottom up rather than from the top down. By including everyone in the decision-making process, each person feels a decision is their own and that they have the responsibility to carry it out. In the words of Eileen Caddy, co-founder of Finhorn, the purpose of Finhorn was not to develop good-willed, obedient servants, but rather to empower individuals to be self-initiating and responsible. The process of unity through common consent requires that a community practice right human relations, our third Zion principle. Community members profess that unity and oneness can only come about as we work through our differences, learn to overcome the ego, and respect the needs of others. We must become our brother's keeper and seek the well-being of all creatures. One of the greatest challenges in community living is developing a process for coping with differences that arise between individuals. This process should neither dwell upon nor suppress these differences, but rather work to bring all relationships to a state of love and unity. In an effort to resolve their differences, many communities are pioneering techniques in conflict resolution and communication skills. David Spangler, former member of Finhorn, notes, "Community takes mutuality, the willingness to be connected, to take on another's well-being, to recognize oneself and the other. Communities are woven from personal social contracts of accountability and commitment. Seeking the good of our neighbors includes the idea of service. Most successful communities are not just turned in on themselves, meeting their own needs, but have a larger purpose in serving society in some way. To quote Stephen Gaskin of The Farm, if God is God at all, he wants justice and freedom and health and happiness and equality for everyone. If you know that's what God really wants, you'll help out along those lines." Modern intentional communities extend this idea beyond the human domain and feel the need to care for the earth and all the life it contains. They feel we must recognize our oneness with the animal and plant kingdoms and recognize the spirit of God therein. To quote David Spangler, the concept of a spirit, an intelligence, a God moving within nature and ordering all its aspects is the foundation for a new relationship between humanity and a world that will unfold a planetary Eden for the benefit and growth of all forms of life. End quote. Just as the United Order's intention was to bring about the glory of God as well as the salvation of mankind, these communities believe that by seeking to do God's will above all else, we can let go of the present world to build a new and better one. Most intentional communities are founded on the belief that their greatest calling is to manifest the will of God, and it is His will that is guiding and directing them to build better systems of economics, politics, and relationships. They believe that only in this way can mankind evolve into its final destiny as the offspring of God. Quoting from Cooperation with Spirit, remember that the most precious gift you have is your intelligence and your free will, your capacity to think for yourself, to be true to yourself, and to grow as a unique expression of divinity. To restate the two greatest commandments through the eyes of the members of the Forum, here are the keys to heaven. Love God and love your neighbor as yourself. And here are the keys to hell. Well, I know I've got to take care of others, but I just want to get a little for myself first. We trust that you have been able to feel the spirit of these communities as we have attempted to outline their values and beliefs. Now we have come full circle to the dilemma we stated earlier, waiting on the Lord. David Spangler has said, a fault which arises in human conception is to perceive God as an external force and thus to assume an attitude and a posture of passive waiting on the Lord. One must learn the patience of right timing, but that patience itself is active participation in the rhythm and balance of divine life. And as Brigham Young once said, we are not going to wait for angels or for Enoch and his company to come and build Zion, but we are going to build it. When we conclude to make Zion, we will make it, and this work commences in the hearts of every person. Joseph and Brigham constantly had before them the vision of Zion. It seems that we have turned our backs on that vision. We have been given a commandment to live according to the laws of the celestial kingdom. Observance of these laws will lead to the establishment of Zion, a society based upon equality, unity, and brotherly love. However, we as a people have decided it is impossible to live this way. I would submit to you that it is impossible to live the law, but only because we have chosen not to. We have exercised our free will and rejected the order of God, and to appease our conscience, we create the fallacy that we cannot live it at this time. A second fallacy is to believe that at some unknown time in the unforeseeable future, the Lord will snap his fingers, say the word, and we will suddenly be transformed, or the enemy who is keeping us from living these laws will be destroyed, and we will instantly be able to establish Zion. The point is this: Zion is going to happen. While we are waiting for the Lord to snap his fingers, it appears that others are experimenting and coming up with workable blueprints. They are trudging through the difficult questions and finding answers. We use the attitude that the time is not yet right simply to release us of our responsibility and put it on future generations. The danger is that Zion will come and we will not recognize it, and will wake up only in time to see that Zion has fled. In his remarks at the dedication of the St. George Temple, Brigham Young made this statement in prophecy: "Hear it, ye elders of Israel, and mark it down in your logbooks. The fullness of the gospel is the united order and plural marriage. And I fear that when I am gone, this people will give up the two principles which we have prized so highly, and if they do, this church cannot advance as God wishes it to." Note that Brigham Young does not say the church will cease to exist, nor does he say it will cease to advance, but that it will cease to advance, or it cannot advance as God wishes it to. If the church is not advancing as the Lord wishes, where does the fault lie? We the people are at fault for not seeking a change of heart and committing ourselves to the vision of Zion. Our leaders are at fault for choosing a modern institutional format of managerial efficiency at the expense of individual growth. Milenko Mantanovich of Finhorn has said, and I quote, "Many spiritual organizations have traded their quest for virtue and inner integrity for the organizational power. They act out the premise that in order to have impact on our world, they themselves must become like the world. So they seek numbers and expansion and thus dilute their own spiritual effectiveness." Zion cannot be forged on the strength of a theory or a commandment. People, including leaders and members, must grow into a sense of unity. We are not proposing that the church attempt to implement a United Order pilot program. What we are suggesting is that as a church, we must get back to having the vision of Zion constantly before us. There are specific things we as a church can do to decrease the amount of organizational abuse and increase unity, equality, and brotherly love. In the church, the idea of unity is often seen as obedience to our leaders. Blind obedience robs us of the chance to experience growth through self-governance. Unity through uniformity is the ideal of unquestioning obedience, but it is not part of the vision of Zion. We have looked at the way some communities function under common consent. In the church, common consent has been reduced to the sustaining vote. Our leaders make decisions, and we are asked to sustain those decisions, but not to participate in the decision-making process. What would it be like if we were given more responsibility in making decisions about ward and stake budgets, new programs, meeting schedules, and the building program, to name just a few? Compare the sacrifice, dedication, and love of the members that went into the construction of our early buildings with the way our sacred buildings are constructed today by companies that have no understanding of them but have submitted the lowest bid. We have discussed how the Lord has commanded us to be equal. It is evident that we are not. Worldly respectability has become more important to us than equality. As Hugh Nibley has put it, they want to be good and rich at the same time, so they reach a compromise called respectability, which is nothing less than Babylon masquerading as Zion. Rather than function under the laws of equality, we are existing under the false assumption that the more money we make, the more tithing we can pay, the more blessings we will receive, and the more money we will make. Our symbol of righteousness is dressed in a three-piece suit and carries an attaché case to priesthood meeting. By promoting respectability, we come to accept and emulate the values of the world rather than the things of God. We could well apply the words of Jacob to ourselves. Think of your brethren like unto yourselves, and be familiar with all, and free with your substance, that they may be rich like unto you. Before you seek for riches, seek for the kingdom of God. This brings us to the third area, brotherly love. Often it seems we become so involved with the curriculum and programs of the church that we don't have time to be involved with the needs of those around us. This also applies to our relationship with those outside the church who we often see only as potential missionary contacts. How many of you have known someone who has stopped going to church because their feelings were hurt by some unthinking leader or fellow member? The problem is not that this happens, but rather when it does, there is no recognized system to deal with it. Many of the problems we face in the church are due to our inability to relate and communicate with one another. This could be solved through effective steps of conflict resolution. There are many members of the church who are true humanitarians, but it seems that they become that on their own rather than through church programs. Our focus has been one of entertainment and success development rather than caring for the poor and needy. It is a great disservice we do to the youth of the church when we entertain them with super fun, super expensive, super activities and deny them the opportunity to learn the joy that comes through true service. It also seems that the motto, "Charity never faileth," has been buried under a well-meaning pile of handcrafted cookie baskets and straw flower wreaths. And although we boast a very efficient and successful internal welfare system, individual members seem to have little opportunity to experience this work of love and service. Do monthly donations alone teach us the heartfelt lessons of true compassion? Mormons do not have a monopoly on goodness. If we can escape the trappings of ego-centeredness, dogmatism, and Mormon culture, we may be able to learn valuable lessons from the work of the communities we have discussed today. Our intent has been to share with you what we have found to be some interesting correlations between the teachings in the Doctrine and Covenants and the present beliefs of the modern community movement. We must realize that the building of Zion is totally dependent upon us as individuals and not on some magical future event. To quote Stephen Gaskin of The Farm, "You are the people. You are this season's people. There are no other people this season. If you blow it, it's blown." The ultimate test for us is to grow, to change, and to take responsibility for what lies before us. Groups, including churches, go through cycles of growth. We need to determine where we are in our cycle. Solid spiritual roots in the ground of experience and slow organic growth, like a tree, are essential for sustained and balanced development. We must be sure that we nurture the Zion seed, that it is in good soil, and that the suns of managerial efficiency don't scorch it and cause it to wither. In one of Brigham Young's last discourses, he queried, "How long shall God wait for us to sanctify ourselves and become one in the Lord, in our actions and in our ways for the building of the kingdom? How long, O Lord, how long shall it be?" I'll be happy to entertain questions as long as they're relevant and easy. No. The question is that the possibility that there are things going on in the church that are building Zion, and how that I would comment on that. I believe that there are. I don't mean to sound like that. I'm saying the church isn't doing anything. The whole point that we wanted to bring up in the paper is this dilemma where we're told that Zion will not be established until the Lord decides when it will. And yet, from our research, it seems that the Lord has told us to establish Zion. And so a large percentage of the people in the church are waiting for that to happen and are getting lost in the programs and other things in the church that, in my estimation, maybe aren't as important as other things. But there are still people who are trying to establish some semblance of Zion within their own wards. Some wards are better than others. Some wards have a real feeling of community while others have none. I think the point is that the establishment of Zion is not dependent upon the Lord, but it is dependent upon us. And I think there are things going on in the church that are good and moving towards that, but I personally don't think there's enough. And I don't think that we're getting it from the leadership. I think it's a grassroots thing, which maybe if the organization is to be run from the bottom up, that's where it has to happen. And then the people will make the leadership realize that we want something more than managerial efficiency. We want conflict resolution. We want common consent. We want to be involved in making decisions, and then it'll happen.
When I was young, the LDS missionaries went out all over the world inviting people to come to Zion, and I felt like I lived in Zion. About 10 years ago, a sacrament meeting was completely devoted to showing what Zion is, and that it's really an attitude, that it is no longer considered a place, but it is considered an attitude. Would you give us maybe a sentence or two definition on exactly what you mean when you say establish Zion?
I think it's both. I think that, first of all, it starts with an attitude. That's where Brigham Young talks about the change of heart. We will not have Zion until we all have a change of heart and understand what the true teachings of Christ are, to care for one another and to be equal and one. But then also there's the belief in the last days that there will be a place, a refuge, called Zion. Now, whether that is going to be spread out in all the stakes of the church, I don't know. But it seems like in reading books like The Coming of the Lord, that some of the revelations and at least beliefs that the church has is that there will be also a place. And I know that the whole idea and attitude towards that has changed in my lifetime, even where we were told that Zion is where the pure in heart dwell and it can be anywhere, and so the people were told to stay in their own countries and establish Zion there. But then that could also be, I think it's both. I think it's both a change of heart and it can be a concrete place. Yes?
These communities you show seem to be all agricultural communities. If everybody lives in an agricultural community like this, what would be the impact on industry and services, roads, government roads?
A lot of them are agricultural, and except the one community, Stella community in Illinois that we highlighted, is dependent upon industry. They have a plastics factory, and they even produce things for NASA, and they also have an alcohol plant. They produce alcohol from corn, and they're working on industrial kinds of things. And other communities are also working on industries rather than agriculture, but they seem to start out as agricultural communities because they're trying to be self-sufficient. They're trying to be able to grow their own food and things such as that. And I'm not saying that we have to all pack our bags and go and live in the country again. I think that there are ways that the principles that they are working with experimenting with can be implemented on an urban scale as well. And there are some urban communities in San Francisco and in South Africa that exist in urban areas. So, is that? Yeah.
I really want to thank you for putting out that information that we continue to progress, and we haven't already been focusing on desire.
Blow it. Thank you. Yeah.
I've been fortunate enough to have been in some of these communities, and I'm fresh on the experience of spending a weekend with a community that we would identify more with, and that would be a church, particularly a house church in Nashville, Tennessee. And I fell under the romantic spell and the charm of these communities. I currently live in an artist community that's in sort of psychological shambles because of rights of ownership and things of this sort. But I think the roadblock for sort of new age communities that they will reach, and I think the obstacle that we will be able to leave because we have presented a particular issue that they have not, and that is that these communities are very like-minded. These are people of common values, common lifestyles, common desires, common abilities, common backgrounds. Whereas we don't have that luxury, we kind of get thrown into a demographic hodgepodge of people that I would no more spend, 10 minutes with on choice in my whole life, and given the obligation. That man right there is your responsibility, not, these little choice little, communities that people can make. And, I find that the saving grace of the current dilemma we're in right now is that we are dealing with such a diversity of lifestyle and such a diversity of values within our community that it's hard to get on hand with things and work. But I think when we evolve past that, we are going to be in a much better position to evolve where I think these communities, and like I say, I've idealized and romanticized and lived in these communities myself. They have their limitations that the gospel or the true community design, I think, will not have.
Mm-hmm. I don't want it to sound like I'm putting these groups up as an example for us to follow. It's like I said, I don't believe that they're establishing the Lord's appointed Zion, if there is one. But I think that they're willing to take the steps that sometimes it seems like we are not willing to do. And I agree with you that one of the most difficult things we have to do in the church is to overcome our personal difficulties with one another. And that perhaps... Well, they've become safe places. I don't think, when I've seen the evolution of some of these communities, and they didn't start out as safe places, but they've become that. And they've had a lot of growth themselves and gone through some difficult times and almost...
There's a price we're going to have to pay.
Right, exactly. And that's, I don't think, at this point in time, we as a whole are willing to pay that price because we're too involved in our own special interest things.
But there are, and I go back to the team, there are those that are.
Yeah.
As I saw the slides, I was struck by the similarities between those new communities and the neighborhood where I live, which is a planned community, a of houses in the $150,000 to $250,000 range, and I'm starting to feel really good about it because we buy things, you know, cooperatively, mulch, we truck in mulch and things like that. We have a very strong neighborhood association. We have common facilities. We have lakes that we stock with fish and things like that. And it's making me think we get along really well in that neighborhood. When I work on my yard, I work on the common area, which is nearby. And we do that as I'm there's, I guess, two Mormons that live in there. And maybe part of the answer, if you go home and say, gee, we ought to have a Zion Society, is to go up and follow President Kimball's advice to clean up your own yard.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, yeah. And just start where you are
sure.
in the community and work like that. And then, you know, I feel very good if we can do that there,
yeah.
that we ought to be able to do that as well.
Yeah. Again, I'm not saying that we should all pack our bags and run to Finhorn, you know. I think to a certain... Exactly. You can do it right where you're at if you're willing to pay the price. And I think that the intentional communities are showing us a possibility that we can accomplish right in our own neighborhoods, in our own wards, wherever we're at, if we're willing to try to establish those feelings of cooperation, whether it's with Mormons or Catholics or whoever. It doesn't matter who it is. You know, just that there are things that we can do cooperatively together and create a better world. And so
it's an attitude. It's that everyone feels like the whole neighborhood is their responsibility. So they pick up trash if it's on my
mm-hmm.
lawn. And it's really interesting
mm-hmm.
to live that way.
Yeah. Congratulations. I have some publications and some books that I quoted in the paper up here that you're welcome to look at if you'd like. So, thank you very much.